least get started, and then the folks trickle in as we normally do. So you're in for a treat if you don't know this guy. No, wait. You're in for a treat. Yeah, if you're in for a treat if you don't know this guy. That's what I meant.
If you do, we're so sorry that you're here. That's really the way the intro works.
So Mr. Eric Reed is the, well, he's a friend, but he's also the guy who, on a step of faith, went out and started Imago. He had kind of a critical mass of folks who had said to him, yeah, you know, it would be cool if there was a group of artists who, like, loved Jesus and loved art and, you know, got together and stuff. And the found some folks to, found a folk to start it up. And here we are, eight years later. In its latest form.
No white. Yeah, it's white now.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you really have no white in your beard?
Oh, for sure. Okay. Yeah, wow. For sure.
So, thanks for being here. You are now officially a guinea pig, because unlike the talk last semester, which was repeated from the spring semester, this totally brand new, all fresh stuff, and if it goes really bad, Eric Reed, R-E-E-D, was the guy teaching it. But
right.
I think it will go really well.
It goes really good.
Fascinating topic.
We'd be shocked.
And it's actually one I know you are very passionate about. The idea of story and art. You have said, and I think it's very true, all art tells a story. Even if it's a really bad story or a lame story, like, it's something. Even Thomas Kincaid, it tells a story. It's just a story that gives you a cavity. But I digress. So without further ado, open us up in a brief prayer.
Oh, yeah, it's great. Okay. Yeah.
God, we thank you so much for this chance we have to gather together in your name for the purpose of becoming more like you. Lord, we ask that you open our hearts and minds to what you have to teach us. You would open up our spirits and use the power of story both in our personal growth and our witness, the way we affect others. Thank you so much for this group and for a church who supports it and lets us be here. So in your son's name, amen.
Amen.
There's only one rule.
What's the rule?
He has messed with our minds.
Mm-hmm.
Philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, John is like,
yeah,
this is not working.
we had a Ouija board. I didn't clear it with
the Ouija board. That's so good.
Yeah.
Just don't say the code word pineapple around Peggy or bad
things. Oh no.
I'm joking.
So as Dr. John said, you really are guinea pigs. The idea of story has been something that I think we all think about from the time we're little kids, whether it's we close our eyes at night and we dream, and for me, I had these repetitive dreams of ants. I have no idea what this means, but ants like covering me up, and I'd wake up just slapping the sheets. Or if I'm awake, I was daydreaming about stuff. I thought I was Bruce Lee for about 3.5 years and found out on a little recess time in the second grade that I wasn't when I was standing on top. What's that? Yeah, I think it's on. Yeah. Well, no, it's all good. Yeah, it's good. In second grade, there was a girl named Tracy Lohorn, and I had blonde hair and a ponytail, and I wanted to impress her, and this was when playgrounds were actually more like playgrounds, hard-packed dirt and asphalt, really tall slides with no real protective devices, swings that were super tall, and you could have a great time. And I was on top of the slide, and I had seen Bruce Lee jump from buildings and do somersaults and land on his feet and then take out the bad guys. And so I see Tracy walking near the slide, and I was near the top of the slide, so I was like, it's on. This is go time. This is when I get to show what I'm made of. And so I stand on top of the slide, and the slide is at least 8-9 feet tall. And she's walking by, and I jump off and try to flip, and I wake up, I'm in the nurse's office. I've got an ice pack on my head, cold rag around my neck, and I don't know how long I had been out, but I didn't get Tracy. I got a mild concussion. And so even when I was awake, I was thinking of stories and imagining stuff. And if you're an artist, and I want us to introduce ourselves in just a minute, but you got into art because of story at some level. You're telling some story to an audience, and it could just be your own self. You know, sometimes we create to understand ourselves. And so what I'd like to do tonight is to sort of do, you know, the fundamental questions of, well, what is story? Why is it so popular? You know, what does it do for us? And just sort of get all that out of the way preliminary this week. I've got some homework that I want to give you. Next week, we'll begin to look at the storytelling God, God as storyteller, and Christ as an expression of that, and we'll look at some parables. And I'll give you some homework after that, as I want you to begin to explore your personal story in five-year blocks. And if you've never done this, it will be very, very helpful. I will not make you stand emotionally naked and share all of this with everyone in the room. It's really for your well-being, for you to begin to see where God has been at work in your life already. Because I think as artists, that is going to make you a more sensitive artist, a more spiritual artist, and you will grow closer to God in the process of that. And then we'll begin to look at different forms of art and how those different forms of art can actually bring a story to people. And there's different strengths and weaknesses of each medium that we use, and in just a minute, so be thinking, you're going to introduce yourself. I'm going to ask you what you hoped to get from this class, like why are you here? And then what's your connection with the arts? And so, you know, if you're a painter, well, let us know a little bit about that. And if we can probably hit that, you know, sort of, hate to say 30 seconds-ish, but if we do that, that'll give us time to hit around the room, and then we'll dive in. And so your Rangers, who wants to go first? We could just do that. But I my medium of choice right now is photography and digital design. It used to be more poetry and stuff like that, and I've moved away, and I have found that photography fits my life where I'm at. I've got four kids. They're all in the busy season right now, sort of age 7 to age 14, three different schools, four different sports. And I'm married, by the way, so the marriage also, you got to work on that thing all the time. And then I'm on staff here at the church, and that's, if you're a man, we've got a men's retreat next weekend, so that's all percolating. So photography is something I feel like I can do everywhere I go. Well, it sounds like if I were to pull a couple of themes out that I heard, one is sort of the idea of testimony a little bit, of story. So I will try to work that in since we are sort of going from eight, you know, from 1 to 6, you know, week 1, week 2, week 3. We're going to touch on that and incorporate some of that, but maybe we'll beef that up a little bit more than what I was thinking we would do. And the course, it should be called The Power of Story. And so storytelling will be a part of that. It's like storytelling proper, but it's not a class. I don't think it's going to be a class on how to write a story. I don't think that was really, I didn't want to communicate that. I was trying to communicate how do we better communicate our story and the stories that have drawn our attention through the medium that we have chosen. And it's been said, Ed Catmull, who is the head guy at Pixar, there's a quote from him. He says, "Story is the way we communicate with each other at every level." Story is the way we communicate with each other at every level. He said, you know, when he arrived, this whole Pixar idea, when he arrived, he said we had like the best CGI, but the best CGI with a bad story is a waste of money. He said everything hinges on the story. And so, Kyle, when you're talking about the story, that story, it's going to be powerful, you know? So whether or not you feel like you can live up creatively to the quality of the story, you don't have to doubt the quality of the story. And so as artists, I would hope that we get to that spot where we begin to say, My limit is not that the story I'm communicating, but the limit maybe is my technical ability. And because we can grow the technical ability, but we could be the best painter in the world, the best photographer in the world, but if we're not communicating something bigger than the technique, I think we're missing why maybe God has given us the gifts in the arts that He's given to us as we steward those gifts, because they're ultimately His. I want to ask you all the fundamental question, you know, what is story? And so what are some ways we can define story? And I'm not going to be the guy that lets you answer them. Nope, that's wrong. What I really want you to say is X. I mean, just when you hear a story, what do you think of? What's story?
It's a way of communicating an idea.
Okay, a way of communicating an idea. Mm-hmm. Somebody else, what's story?
I think it's simply what when and where. What happened, when and where.
Okay. What, when, and where, and maybe it carries an idea with it, right? Transports the idea through that medium. Any other ideas on story? What is story? Let me throw... Here's one. It says, a narrative or story in its broadest sense is anything told or recounted. More narrowly and more usually, something told or recounted in the form of a casually linked set of events, which is what you're sort of referring to, an account, a tale, the telling of a happening or connected series of happenings, whether true or fictitious. So you're going to be hitting a true story, but I made up stories all the time for my kids of Max and Baxter. They were two bears, and they had adventures every day, and Max and Baxter became stories that the kids would be like, you know, we want to hear about Max and Baxter. Well, the problem was I didn't have an infinite array of imagination and creativity. So I'd recycle the themes of Max and Baxter and just change geographic locations. And that stopped, they figured it out, you know. And so Max and Baxter have gone to bed for a long time. They're still hibernating.
In fact, I know you can tell a lot about a person's worldview through their version of story.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a nice way to break down cultures or to communicate on a real basic level. And you start storying because you're hearing about their worldview. Like, for instance, the Cinderella story is in almost every culture.
Mm.
And the Chinese Cinderella was the first one, not the one in Germany. So I love that story because who's coming to save us? Who's our prince?
Mm-hmm.
And it really gets a way in, you know, not to hammer home a gospel message, but to really have a discussion. Women like to, wherever they are, have a cup of tea or coffee and discuss.
Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. That's great. Here's another. The story is a tale that is made up for entertainment, mm-hmm, or a retelling of something that occurred or a piece of gossip that is spread. I thought that was interesting. Entertainment. And we're going to talk about that in just a minute. The difference, entertainment, amusement, some of these ideas. And here's one that I think is more centered in what I think it's a narrative, either true or fictitious, in prose or verse, designed to interest, amuse, or instruct the hearer or reader through the tale. And so I think story, if we think about story, it's something, it doesn't have to be real, it can be made up. It will carry a worldview, it will carry ideas, it will carry emotion with it, and we're telling it ultimately to communicate something to someone. And I love, you know, the idea is that we could no more talk about humans without stories than fish without water, that we swim as humans in a world of stories. Where did I come from? Who am I today? What happened today? Where am I going? Why did this happen? Even if we don't have an answer, we'll make up a story to figure it out, to go there. And so I think stories are pretty simple in that way. They're a recounting or a telling, whether real or fictitious, and we're trying to communicate some ideas and narrative. So they are global, so why are they so dominant? Why do we find stories literally everywhere? My kids did not have to be raised and taught, you should tell story. They, as early as they started talking, when I have been gone, I would come home, and guess what they would tell me? They'd tell me a story. Tell me what they were doing. Dad, you missed it. I mean, missed what? Well, there was a squirrel, and he was running on the back of the fence, and he fell off, and, you know, and I've got a photo of it because he didn't get out of the bucket. So they don't swim. I was like, you should have just tumped the bucket over. But anyway, that's another story for another day. But it's a real, I'll pass it around. It's an absolutely real story that happened. And if you're squeamish, there's no blood. But this is the wonder.
Oh, he's taking a nap in the pool.
This is absolutely a real story. And I found out about it because they were talking about the squirrel that fell off the fence and went into this bucket. And I thought, well, that's sort of cool. And then 2 days later, I start smelling that squirrel that went into the bucket.
I believe you.
I'm good.
Yeah, I'm good. So...
And you just told us a story, and
it
made us all happy.
That's right.
Stories are dominant for design or chance. Our brains are, they latch on to stories much better than lists of facts. So day job, I'm a physician, and so rather than give somebody a list of... you know, here's the three medicines you're going to take, and here's the order you're going to take them. Nobody remembers that. That's what you write down. But if I can give them a sort of logical flow of, well, this happened, and so we're going to do this, and then there's also this happened, so we're going to do this other thing, it just sticks in their memory better. Mm-hmm. When I'm taking a history of someone's telling me about their cough, I realized that, you know, I can't just get the facts because I don't get many policemen in there that just going to give me the facts. They just have to tell the story in their way, and maybe it involves, well, we were at the dry cleaners and, you know, Billy started coughing because, you know, it was a cold day in July and it was humid also and the windows were down. I told them to roll the window down. And that's how their brains work. And in order to access the file with all the clues, you got to let them tell their story. That's just how we work.
That's really good.
So I would think that's why they're...
That's really good. I'm going to mention some books along the way, and I don't endorse everything in any of these books individually, but there is a book written, the guy's last name is Gottschall, Gottschall, and it's called The Storytelling Animal. And it's about how humans are designed, in a sense, for story. In his research, and he sort of went to science, ironically, our medical doctor. So I would say stories are dominant. Number one is because of design. Design. The most recent research shows that we spend about 50% of our waking hours. Now, that means about a third of our life. 50% of our waking hours spinning dreams and fantasies. Now, in this group of a couple of hundred people that they researched, checked out the brains and all that stuff, they found on average we have 2,000 daydreams with the average duration of 14 seconds a day. That's the average person. So the joke is that our minds literally flit around creating all the time until there's something that we have to focus on and do, at which time we sort of close it down and we start working on it. Now, if you have a thing like I probably do with ADD, ADHD, then what happens is after about 5 minutes max, it starts flitting around again, and you've got to bring it back to the task at hand or else you never get it done. You'll forget, you'll walk to the store and what am I here for? You'll be thinking about everything else but the task at hand. And so I thought it's interesting that our minds are made for wandering, W-A-N-D-E-R-I-N-G, and wondering, like thinking about stuff. Just think about your experience in your life and waking up and going to bed and dreaming and all those things. Are you more or less like that average multi-thousand, 2,000 times a day? Do you find your mind wandering in and making up a story or thinking about things creatively or differently than just what's right before you? Another facet of story and storytelling and the power of it is it's replicable. I mean, my kids, they'll come back and they'll tell me a joke that they heard at school, which is sometimes a story or a small story-like little thing that comes out, but they can remember that. Where what you said is your patients can't remember, I need to take it in this order, but if you tell them a story with that order in it, they'll remember it. And so it's easy to repeat and replicate those things. Does that mean it changes? And we're going to do some homework where I want us to practice telling in our own words some of the stories from the Bible, but modernizing them. And I'm not trying to be sacrilegious in doing that, but I think it helps us feel and understand some things differently if instead of it being a farmer, a sheep, or something else that maybe we don't experience on a daily level, it becomes something very real in our life, and it brings that feeling of impact. Does that make sense? And so by design, we're storytelling creatures. They're replicable, which is great. And then the third deal is it's where we form our meaning from. It's where we form our meaning or our worldview. So without story, we arrive in the world and we have no clue where we are, how we got here, or anything. Imagine, being a kid that's just dropped off in the middle of nowhere, but that for some reason you've got a bottle of nourishment and a system to deliver it to you, but there's no one else around. And you have to figure out who you are, where you came from, why you're here. I cannot imagine a more daunting task or a more interesting movie than something like that. And so when we think about that, we'll jump into this already. So if I use the word existentialism, if I throw that word out, what are some names that come to your head? Existentialism. Are there any?
Thoreau?
He's more of a...
Transcendentalist
guy.
Robin Williams, because he made jokes about existential.
He did.
Disneyland.
That's right.
You sit there, deride. It does nothing, a lot like life.
That's right. So Robin Williams would be a modern guy. Seinfeld show is a show about what?
Nothing,
which is a very existential deal, right? But if we go further back, We come to guys like Albert Camus and Jean-Paul Sartre, and all these guys are there. But if you go back to the very beginning of existentialism, and when we think of existentialism, it's a very godless philosophy. We arrive and we create our own meaning because there is no transcendent meaning. We provide the meaning to our own existence by the story that we choose to tell about ourselves and live out.
Wait, say that again.
That's sort of existentialism. We arrive and we create our own meaning. We create the meaning of our life by the story that we choose to tell and live in our life. And there's nothing before it and there's really nothing after it. I exist and I have being out of my own existence, and that's the grand sum total of it all. So, of course, what helped us get there was guys that would say God is dead, Nietzsche, and other philosophers that were very godless. But if you go back to the very origin of that concept and idea, it was a guy named Soren Kierkegaard, a Danish thinker and theologian and writer. And he wrote in the early 1800s about the idea of the individual as opposed to the collective. It's interesting because the Industrial Revolution hadn't hit yet, And he was concerned about the individual, that an individual had existence apart from the mass of people. And because of that, there was a uniqueness. Well, for him as a Christian, he saw that in the Scriptures, that there was this relationship you could have with Christ. But he wrote a lot of essays, and he wrote a lot of treatises, and he didn't write any plays, and he didn't tell a lot of stories. But the atheistic guys wrote plays and stories and movies and songs, and even actors and actresses and comedians, and they propagated it. So that today, what version of existentialism actually carries the day in our world? And it's the atheistic and very hopeless existentialism won out. And it won out because it created the story and the meaning for an entire culture of people. And the Christian was telling propositions and not stories. And no one really wanted to read a long, thick book. But they say that our worldview is caught more than taught, but it's caught in story. That, as you said, story delivers the ideas. Where if I tell you a fact, like there is a God, you can shut that thing down at the onset if you want to. But if I tell you a story about a man who had no hope at all in life, and all of a sudden another person enters their life, where did they come from? And mysterious person arrives, and they bestow grace, and they do things that no one thought was possible. And now the plausibility is, well, I wonder, that idea now opens me up to the possibility that there could be someone that could do things that we would say is impossible in a scientific world. And now that story could carry the beginning of, the seeds of the gospel, or Cinderella could carry the seeds of the gospel far better than me trying to debate somebody to the gospel.
Can you have a story without experiences?
Can you have a story without define experiences?
Well, you said what got me thinking about that is story is where we form our worldviews. And I thought, well, I didn't form my worldviews from, I mean, a lot of people do form them from stories that you hear, but and that's how maybe they initially formed, but then they've completely changed through experiences.
Right.
And so can you have a story without experiences? And I think if you go back to the existentialism argument that you were making, that's kind of a Western, but like a guy in China during communist China, he's still feeling that existential because he's in this mass of people and he's trying to break out. And that's partly why the gospel got spread through China so quickly. But I don't know. I don't know if you can have a story without experiences.
Well, you can't. Yeah, because receiving, and we're going to talk about where are the sources of stories. Mm-hmm. And let me see where we are in sort of the outline.
I didn't mean to.
No. We'll jump a question here. There are only two sources for story. At least this is my guess.
Okay.
We either receive them from outside of us, i.e. someone else originates the story, or we project a story upon our event. And so let me give you an example. 2001 or two, I ended up having 3 rear-end collisions in about a year and a half. Now, I wasn't speeding. I was actually stopped at a red light. I was obeying the law. I was coming back from either church or Bible study every time. I'm watching. The first time it happened, it surprised me. And I didn't really get hurt. Car got mangled pretty good, but I didn't get hurt. The second one, I turn around and I watch this guy coming in this huge Buick, and it had been raining, and he's going like 60 miles an hour, and I'm stopped, and it's right out here. There used to be a Fiesta, and now I don't know what the store is, but it's like Campbell Road or something like that. And Blaylock. And I'm stopped there at the red light, and we make eye contact. And I don't even know if he ever hit the brake. And I'm turned sort of partially around, and he hits the back of the car. And I don't have photos on my phone, but I can show you photos. And the whole rear end and the backside, it was a Civic. were just shoved up there and drove me into the intersection there. And it was a Sunday evening. I was coming back from Second Baptist. I used to go to Second Baptist. Coming back from there. And that began a degeneration in my back. I had competed in athletics my whole life, competed in college. I had coached. I was coaching at the time, cross country, wrestling, and track. And it's been 10 years since I've been able to run. 10 years since I've been able to lift weights. Now I can do pull-ups, which is great, but that doesn't really, that's a pretty limited activity. I've done years of chiropractic care, years of physical therapy, and years of pharmaceuticals, and I quit all of it because nothing made anything better, and I was spending $3,000, $4,000 a year, and I had multiple kids, and I was like, it's not worth it. As long as I can walk, that's great. The problem is, I was really angry with God because I'm like, God, this is my first love, is running. I was getting punished for being late to practice and I was running. Everybody else that was late, they stopped running and hid behind the air conditioning unit of this gym because we were running around the outside of the gym. There were these big AC units and they were hiding, looking down the line of this little prefab metal building, waiting for the coach to open the door, and then they'd hop up and run. But after about 20 laps around the gym, I started feeling good. I was like, this is great. And so I discovered that I loved running as punishment for being late to wrestling practice. So when I got a chance to competitively run, it made sense to me is, why would I not do this? I love it. So then to lose that, which had been a part of my life since really the fourth grade, was really hard because it allowed me to get my anger out. It allowed me to deal with lust, specifically, you know, instead of lusting and then that leading to activity, I would just go out and run and I would exhaust myself. And so then that's great. It's a healthy thing. All of a sudden, God took that away. And so there's about a 3-year window of Eric reading God dialogues. And I was a Christian the whole time, but it was not friendly. It was like Lieutenant Dan in Forrest Gump, you know, just mad at God and beginning to act out like, well, this is your body, God, so if you're not going to take care of it, I'm not going to take care of it. And so there's other stories behind that, but I'm sharing that because what I found myself doing was I was trying to make up a reason it happened. And so I was like, well, God knew that if I was trying to run these marathons that I wouldn't be available to my kids, and so my kids would never know me, so my kids would hate me. And so he took running away because he knew that I would never moderate it. Or that I would have met a lady and we would have ended up having an inappropriate relationship and it would have ruined my marriage. Or I would have been running at 5 or 6 in the morning and a car would have driven onto the road and would have run over me and I would have been dead and God wanted to protect me from that. I was making stories up. And even those stories never removed the aspect of that God asks us to live by faith. That we trust Him with our story. We don't have to fully understand our story, but we trust Him in that story because He's revealed Himself in the big story to be a faithful God that is loving, that is gracious, that is just, that is merciful. And so in my story, when it makes me think differently than God's story, that's where faith comes in, is I have to choose what story will I believe and in what story will I live. And so I think, Kyle, I don't think you can have a story without experience, because for me, even me telling the story to you is an experience for me and you together. I'm going to share a quote from an essay Leo Tolstoy wrote called What is Art? And Google What is Art, and you can start reading it if you want to. We don't have time to read the whole thing, but there is a 3-paragraph section in there that is incredibly rich on art. And I think as a subset of art, story, we're just going to substitute art and story because I think it's going to enrichen a lot of this. Back to the meaning idea. If a doctor comes in and says, hey, you've got 30 days to live, how do you feel?
Quit work,
man. Done. I mean, are you fired up and happy, you know? Like, That's sort of a downer, right? You got 30 days to live. But if we change the story, and the day before he had told you, you've got less than 24 hours to live. Now how do you receive that news?
Excited.
You're excited. Oh my gosh, I've got a new lease on life. All the things that I thought I'd never do again, I'm getting ready to do every single one of those things, right? Well, what's the difference? Not the event, right? It's the story. True? So if you change the story, and I'd write this down, if you change the story, you change the meaning. If you change the story, you change the meaning. And so now let's enter into America today. And in the 1950s, there was an education teacher. His name's Dr. Hall. And if you want to look this up, you can read it in the Moorhead Education Department. Had this, it's, I don't know if I brought it. It's one of the Google books. They digitized a lot of books, and it's in there. But here's a quote from Dr. Hall. He says, "Let me tell the stories, and I care not who writes the textbooks." Let me tell the stories, and I care not who writes the textbooks. So this is an education guy recognizing that meaning is best conveyed not by facts and figure, but by story. And so think about our culture today, and think about Christianity today. Christianity withdrew from arts. They were dangerous. Well, there's nudity. There's profanity. A lot of it's anti-God, right? So we withdrew from arts, but we also withdrew from science, and we abdicated a lot of the textbooks because we were like, well, I don't believe in evolution, so I'm not going to do any science. And we actually abdicated not just the stories, but the textbooks to our culture today. And I will just argue that one reason Imago exists is that we would at least reassert a biblical narrative and a biblical story back out into our culture so that it can begin to open ears, eyes, minds, and hearts to the things of eternity. And that we each have a sphere that we can communicate in. And we may feel like it doesn't really matter. It's not a big sphere. I can't wait to sell a piece. I'm like, you'll sell a piece. Your stuff's awesome. You know? And if you haven't seen his stuff, it's awesome. It's just so, it's full of meaning, and it's also beautiful, and it's symbolic, and it's all that art needs to be. It's just pregnant. It's pregnant with meaning and beauty, and your stories need to be that way. My stories need to be that way. Our stories need to be that way. And we need to get out and tell them. Because everyone else is telling their stories because we swim in an ocean of stories as humans. And so this idea, to me, of the formation of meaning is the third reason stories are so dominant. And so let me go to what is the power of story. And for time's sake, because I want us to, we got a ways to travel here. Let me just, what do stories do for us? And I'll give you, these aren't in any hierarchy, but they bring pleasure. I mean, stories, they bring pleasure to us. I mean, I love it. My kids, I mean, they would choose to read a book or listen to an audiobook over just about anything else. They just love that. And they do that. I always think, man, we shouldn't really listen to so many books on audio, you know. But they also create art. They also make stories and all that. Number two is they develop a sense of community. They develop a sense of community. There are three things that have been said to make a culture. It's the language we use, the stories we tell, and what we celebrate. That those three things make cultures unique from each other. So it's the language we use, the stories we tell, and what we celebrate. And so this idea here then to me of those three, and I don't know which book this idea came from, but my generation, and the one above me, the boomers, and sort of, I'm born the same year Kurt Cobain, so I don't know, that makes me X, the oldest member of X or the last of the boomers, but we're right on that edge. But my early memories were watching my mom watch Watergate, and she's sitting in front of the TV and she starts crying, and I'm like, what's wrong? And she says, well, the president's done something wrong. I just remember that was early on. I remember the Iran hostage situation. I was in the fourth grade, and I remember because I still have my little book report, and it was Put a Hole in the Ayatollah was the title of it. And it was a ripoff of a op-ed piece that I didn't even know what I was writing, but it was horrifically bad writing, and I have no idea what. It was probably they passed me for some reason on that one. It's fourth grade, so that's probably why. But that's a story. And then the Jim and Tammy Baker stuff was a story. And then in my own life, I had a pediatrician, Dr. and he passed away about 2 months ago. My mom sent me his obituary. And in a season in our culture, doctors did no wrong at all. As my mom would, she'd hop into the waiting area, and then I would go in to see Dr. and she would read Red Book. You know, Red Book was out there, and Ladies Home Journal was out there. And she would read the magazine. I'd go to the doctor. The doctor's a great guy. He's taking the Hippocratic Oath. What could possibly go wrong? And yet, unbeknownst to her, and very keenly aware for me, was he was inappropriate with me for a series of years. And I didn't even know it was wrong until I was 16 years old. And I realized in listening to other guys my age, stuff that had been happening to me should not have been happening at all. But I never talked to anyone about it. And that's when I realized I don't trust presidents, I don't trust pastors, I don't trust doctors, I don't trust much of anybody. So I, just like the generation, became very cynical, right? We become very, very cynical. And so in our cynicism, our cultural stories changed. And we began to tell some different stories. The anti-hero would become a hero. And in all of that, it's interesting. For our culture, I think it's bred a cynicism to the gospel and a cynicism to absolute truth and absolute power. Those things are very frightening to me and probably frightening to most of us. And yet, to share what you shared earlier, there's an expression, there's a book, and I'd write this book down. It's called The Echoes of Eden. The Echoes of Eden. That within the stories, even the stories that are anti-establishment, anti-God, anti-church, anti-family, anti-whatever, there are little glimpses of eternal themes that are out there. I don't know if y'all have seen The Kingsman, the Secret Service. Anybody see that? Okay, or you read the graphic novel that it came from for my birthday. That's what I got for my birthday, and I realized I can't let my kids look through that. It's really R-rated, beyond R-rated. But the movie has an unbelievable gospel message in it. A kid that circumstantially is a waste and has no hope and nothing good could possibly come in his life. His father had passed away through betrayal, and his father had, in a sense, given a promise to him that he had had his whole life. And it was associated with a phrase, Oxford, not Brogues, and it was a number he was to call, but he had no need of any of it. He was just living life. But the movie, the inflection point of the movie is he hits rock bottom and he has one phone call to make, and his mind goes back to the promise that had been given, and he makes the call and he can't even remember what the phrase is, and then it comes to him. And from that point on, all of the authority, the benefits, the power, the growth in his life, he becomes a man that eventually, in a sense, helps save humanity. And it's this, it's an over-the-top movie, almost like Tarantino-style movie. But to me, it's an echo of Eden that's in that story, that as cynical as it could be, it has an echo of eternity sitting right there in it. And so I'm sharing that with y'all, is that sometimes there's inflection points in the stories that are told that are the protest stories of our day. And I think if we can find them, we can use those as conversation starters for the gospel. One of my neighbors, a special forces guy that's out of the military, single dad, inventor, which I don't know what that means, because he had a camera on top of his house that was always facing our neighbor's house, and they had three daughters, and they asked him to turn it off, and he didn't. He said it's a security camera, and we were like, unless it's like a missile flying this way, that's not going to help you protect your house. And I took Fight Club over to his house. This was in probably 2003 or 4. And we watched it. And out of that movie at 2 in the morning when we finish it, it started a conversation about what is really real and how do you know it. And out of that story came, well, what do you think's real? And he believed that we were here from UFOs, aliens put us on the planet. And, you know, he talked about crop circles and Stonehenge. And he says, well, what do you think? Well, guess what I get to share with him? I get to share the gospel with Otis. Did he become a Christian? Well, no. But that's one step that wouldn't have happened without the narrative of Fight Club, which I would not endorse it for moral content, right?
Right.
And yet, in the story is echoes of eternity in that story. And so if we're afraid of story that's not clean and neat, we miss, I think, the pagan story, and yet God's put eternity in the hearts of the pagan so that they could still see a semblance of the gospel. Another facet that stories give us. Is this making sense? Mm-hmm. Another facet that stories give us, it provides a vicarious experience for us. It provides a vicarious experience for us. Week 3, we're going to talk about a research that was done on people that viewed film. So I think it'll be very interesting for you, but we're not going to hit it today. But it gives us a vicarious experience. Another thing it does, it arouses enthusiasm and other emotions for us. So why would that even matter to us, you know? Why would arousing emotion in people matter? But you think about, how do we make decisions?
Emotion.
I mean, if 50 cars are going to get me here on time every day, like I can't go 0 to 60 in 3 seconds on I-10 at rush hour. I just can't do it. I see people in a Ferrari and I hurt for them. Like my Hyundai, I get my Hyundai almost up to top speed every day. And I'm still frustrated that there's still about 1,000 RPMs that I'm not able to tap on that engine. There's unused potential on my Hyundai. But if I'm in a Ferrari, I'm sitting here thinking, I'm only using 1% of my horsepower, 90% of my driving life. That's very, very, very frustrating. I would just, inside, I would grieve. It's more fun to drive a bad car fast than a fast car slow. And so in here, we get, our emotions are decided. They help us make these decisions about the car we drive. It's going to promise something more to us. And it's the feelings. We got to get to the feelings of the people that we love and care for in our culture. We need to win the heart, not just the mind. We need to win the heart of the people in our life. They also instruct us through examples. They show me what courage looks like if you've watched Unbroken or read the novel, or if you've met the man, you know, Louis Zamperini. They show us what courage looks like, shows us what sacrifice looks like, what honor looks like, what truth. You name it, there are movies, lots of them. And one reason I love Gladiator. I think it's one of my favorite all-time movies. And yet it's like, you know, that's over the... I love it. I love the nobility of Maximus. I love it. And it's such a foil to one of the weakest characters ever. Weak meaning, if that was a real person living life that way, it would be the most insecure person in the world. And to see that movie, but it also gives us the negative of what to avoid, like greed and lust. If you've, there was a movie with Glenn Close, Fatal Attraction. I remember I was nowhere near getting married. And has anyone seen that? Or only the guys over 40 have seen it? Okay. You watch it, and you'll never, ever, ever, ever conceive of an affair. How many of y'all seen Requiem for a Dream? Okay. Did you watch it to the end?
Yeah.
I've only turned off two movies in my life. I turned off that movie. I turned off the movie, and I told my wife, because she wasn't even watching, she's not going to watch a movie like that. I told her, I said, when we think the kids are old enough to start using drugs, we're going to sit down and watch this movie. Because you'll never, ever, ever use drugs if you watch that movie. I can't imagine it. Because it's such a negative example of addiction. And it's like watching a slow motion train wreck over and over and over. And you're wanting sunlight to pop up. You're wanting something good to happen. And when I realized there's 25 minutes left and it ain't getting any better, I was like, I can't watch any more of this. And I turned it off. And so if you haven't seen it, I'm not endorsing the moral content, but to understand the power of story, you ought to check it out. It's incredibly, incredibly well done and powerful.
What's the name of it?
Requiem for a Dream. I think that.
I never thought I'd ever hear that endorsed in church.
Okay. Again, it's morally reprehensible. Morally reprehensible.
The last 20 minutes is probably the worst.
No, I just knew where it was going. As soon as I could tell what she was getting ready to do,
yeah.
I was like, I can't watch that. Yeah. I can watch him jack up. I'm not going to watch that happen to her.
Yeah.
Can't do it. And then lastly, meaning, identity, and purpose is forged by story. We've already talked about that. The sources of story, we've already talked about it. You can receive it from others, and you can live it yourself. I'll give you a homework assignment next time that's going to begin to get you going down your own life story. Real quickly, how are stories received or delivered to us today? What are some of the forms that stories come to us in?
Conversation?
Yeah, conversation, lunch break, you know, coffee shop.
Really short snippets.
Snippets?
The snippets and sound bites. It's like we're not fed the whole story. We're sort of fed a snippet or a teaser, and we're sort of left to.
Oh yeah.
Add in the fill in the blank.
Yeah, I mean, perfect
or incorrect.
Perfect example is newspaper. My wife will read the headlines, I'll read an article. And then we'll sit down and we'll ask her, what do you think it was? And she'll tell me, and I'll say, did you read the last paragraph? No, read the last paragraph. She says, why did they call it that? Why is that the title? Why is that the title of the article? And I'm like, well, you tell me. What are they wanting you to think? This? Okay, you're being manipulated. So yeah, we get snippets of stories. How else do we get stories? How else do we, in our culture, how are stories delivered?
Facebook,
tweets,
pictures.
How else?
Books.
Books.
This may sound crazy, but I'm going to say text, because if you look at that young generation, we'll just say 25 years later, they don't talk anymore. But you go through their phone, right? It is a story.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, you're absolutely right. It's almost propaganda stories against their non-friendly friends.
After coordinating perspectives on the World Christian Movement for almost 20 years now,
wow.
I know exactly who to invite and who not to.
Mm.
The power of story. You can do a didactic lecture, and it's spot on. It's very, you can replicate it. You can look it up. Every detail is there, but it's not story. I guess one of the best books is Salim Khaled. I love that guy. He's just, he his testimony, his story.
Wow.
And it's powerful. Hmm. Everybody in the room is like this. And a woman in the ministry that I'm in here in Houston, who's from a displaced people's camp for 20 years. And as she tells how she hung on to the wing of the plane as they were pulling her off, trying to put her in.
Oh, my goodness.
She tells her story. It evokes such imagery.
Oh, yeah.
Emotion that you can, you're there. That's hanging on every word.
So, that's great.
You know, it's story is, it's very powerful.
It's great. No, that's.
It just doesn't get it. At least it doesn't for me.
Yeah. No, you're right. Tom?
Back in the day when President Clinton was going through all that stuff with Monica Lewinsky, they had it. He put a book out afterwards. And I was never really much of a President Clinton fan, but I read the book just because of the story value.
Mm-hmm.
And it talked about one of his rises in popularity is he was a good storyteller. Right?
Unbelievable.
He did it into the debate and switch it over to, well, back in Arkansas, we do this and this and this. And it just, it brought the people together. And there's a, what is the name of that movie? Primary Colors, right? It's a takeoff.
Yeah.
John Travolta's in it. And it's really, it's President and Mrs. Clinton. Their
wow.
whole life of getting to the White House for the first time. And it's just story after story after story.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's great. Movies are obvious there. Poetry. If you ever go up to New York City, there's a 9/11 museum. It's not really a museum. It's where all the first responders were staying in the church that had survived the New York fire. It survived 9/11. I mean, it survived hundreds and hundreds of years. Even the windows are original. And you walk in there, and there's a wall of little origami cranes from Hiroshima. Students in Hiroshima had made them for the kids in New York City because they had experienced, their culture had experienced devastation from us bombing. I mean, it was one of those more, you walk in, I remember crying there because I was stirred already, and then I got that. But then there were also some haikus that had been written about 9/11 by students. And a lot of these have been archived. I've got some photos of some of them as well, letters to firefighters. And but you go up there and you realize that a haiku can convey a story, even though it's so finite. I mean, it's so limited, and yet it conveys a story. It's a snapshot. We have TV shows, and the news tells stories. I mean, the news is nothing but stories. Home movies. There are... Everybody here has more technology than Hollywood had in 1950 with us right now. I've got more computing power right here than an entire room full of computers in the 1950s. And yet, what do I do with it? Oh, my goodness.
Or more than even NASA had on the first spaceship.
Right, which is completely tragic. We have oral, spoken, audiobooks, NPR, radio shows, songs. I'm going to throw three songs up real quickly. If you're familiar with Sting at all, I think he is one of the better storytellers that came out of a non-storytelling genre, came out of sort of post-punk movement. It was more about anger and more about energy, and yet this was his, he was writing, and who was it that said they choose their medium based off what they're trying to communicate? Okay, so that's what he did. So he's not a country western singer. And he was writing a story about a man whose wife left him and took the kids to left. And then he found out from a friend that she's got another guy. And he wrote a song. Now, it wasn't his life, because if you followed him at all, he also wrote a song about a story called The Secret Marriage Vow That's Never Spoken, which was about he and his girlfriend who they had lived together for years. And... I'm just going to play part of it. It's highly depressing at the beginning, and then it turns up. There's a little inflection point at the end that, again, it's an echo of eternity. And Toby Keith redid this, and so this was the first. Sting's the first person that's charted like a pop, rock, dance, country, western. Like, he charted every chart, R&B. Like, he actually has charted every chart, and this was the song that did that for him. Oh, I thought it was going to go through there. Can y'all hear this?
Mm-hmm. since she left me. She shows her face to ask me how I am. She says the kids are fine, that they miss me. Maybe I could come and babysit sometime. She says, are you okay? I was worried about you. Can you forgive me? I hope that you'll be happy. I'm so happy that I can't stop crying. I'm so happy. I'm laughing through my tears. I saw a friend of mine, he said, I was worried about you. I heard she had another man. I wondered how you felt about it. I'm so happy that I can't stop crying. I'm so happy I'm laughing too much. So my lawyer, Mr. Good News, he got me joint custody and legal separation. I'm so happy.
Okay, sorry. So he's telling a story, and I mean, you listen to the song, the music hits it, it's all there. I mean, it's like the most depressing deal. And if you've ever been through a broken relationship, I've never been through a broken marriage, but I went through an engaged period, 2.5 years, where she was unfaithful twice. And I eventually was like, I can't say for worse for life with you in front of God and my family and friends. I can't do it. So we can't get married. This just isn't going to happen. Because if it's worse than it is right now, I'm done. Like, I can't do that. And that's God's grace in my life now, redeeming it with a very trustworthy lady of high integrity. That's beautiful, beautiful lady. But that song captured all that hurt bound up and then plus some. And you ought to check it out. Listen to it on YouTube or something. Because it turns, it's a nice turn that, I don't know why it turned the story the way it did, but there's an echo of eternity in the last third of the song. This is a song from one of my favorite folk singers. He was the first vocal performer ever on Windham Hill Records. If you know Windham Hill, that's like George Winston, Will Ackerman, Michael Hedges. They're some of the greatest musicians of the last probably 30, 40 years. And that started the whole New Age music movement. Well, he was the first vocalist they ever allowed on the label, sort of broke the label up in one way. But he wrote a song called Legacy, and he grew up in Alabama. And he's telling a story about the church that he experienced growing up in. And it's incredibly powerful. I got to hear him in a concert, and we sat down, and this was one of the very first stories I asked him about because I wanted to know more. So I'll let you hear some of this. Just why don't you go and leave now?
It is a legacy. Handed down to me, poor dirt farmer, skinny few. He parched the red clay like it was the Red Sea. It is a legacy, both me and you. You are a black man, I am a white man. Both come from the Southland. Both doing best we can. Well, the Grim Reaper is my brother's keeper. The way my brother was kept, small wonder Jesus wept. It is a legacy passed down to you and me. What we're taught to believe, we never question things. It is a legacy, so wild and bitter seed blown across those fertile fields where the roots. words run deep. We both got calloused hands, blue-collared working men, down here in Bubble Land. What's in a name? Both living rent to rent, some own the government. We are quite different, we are the same. It is a legacy passed down to you and me. What we learn to believe, we never question these things. It is a legacy, so wild and bitter sea, blown across those fertile fields where the roots run deep. Where the roots run deep. Oh. Praise Jesus, past the plate, sitting in our Sunday best, singing hymns and mopping sweat. We learn the golden rule, supper at Sunday schools, and a house long divided against itself. It is a legacy passed down to you and me. What we choose to believe, we dare not question these things. It is a legacy, it's a wild and bitter sea, scattered on those fertile fields where the roots run deep. Oh, the roots run deep, where the roots run deep. Oh, where the roots run deep.
So in the 1980s, to write a song about gender ethnic integration into the local church was a pretty daring deal for him to do that. But again, he used art to voice a social injustice and to address it through telling the story of two men that had both lost their brothers, both were blue collar, both worked in agriculture, both loved Jesus, and yet they were in separate churches on Sunday, but all the rest of the time they were together in the field. And that song ends up being a healing force in a lot of the Southern, you know, Baptist and Southern Methodist churches, starting off with that just sort of being a story that provokes social change. We don't have time. Oh, Everclear has a song called "Father of Mine," which is a personal narrative for the singer about an absent father and a lot of anger that comes out of it. So, in art, we also find that the story may be our own story that we tell in a cathartic way, but it also voices that story for 1,000 other kids who never knew their dad or their dad had walked away. And it says, "I'm not alone." So I'm just sharing that our stories we tell don't have to be clean, neat, and tidy. Those are three different stories. All of them are negative in some ways. There's lots of positive stories we can tell, right? But again, without conflict, a story gets boring. Hate to say that. But conflict and tension makes a story interesting. Visually, story. Do y'all remember what day? I mean, do you know what day that is?
World War II ended, right?
Yeah, it's VJ Day. They had announced it. A lot of these guys were in the theaters around New York. They'd been drinking. They come out. They're celebrating. There's a nurse. Here's a guy. I actually interviewed that guy maybe 10 years ago.
That's not his girlfriend? He just grabbed somebody?
He grabbed a girl on the street, and he says he doesn't even remember doing it, but he couldn't deny that was him. And so this is an iconic photo that tells a story. It captures an emotion. Now, you don't have to know the date of it. You just know, man, something awesome is happening. There's a lot of happiness and joy. And this is just this exuberant moment in time that tells a story. Here's another story that was told. And this is considered one of the most powerful photos in the 20th century. It's obviously a story that is uncomfortable for all of us to see from the Vietnam. And to me, my least favorite photo of the Vietnam era is this one. And I actually looked this up because I was curious. They interviewed her 60 years later, something like that. But she was 9 years old at the time. She is still alive today. She still has burns. Her village had just been napalmed by U.S. soldiers. Planes had just napalmed the whole village. She was 9 years old. She's running down. And it's, again, it's just one of those moments that galvanized the peace and anti-war movement. Gave it more fuel. Again, it's a story. I mean, you see it and you're like, you just fill in the story yourself, and it's whatever I come up with is not as bad as what it really was. And so stories, I think, are super powerful, super amazing. They can give us meaning. We can change the story and change the meaning, which I think is what our culture has been doing for the last 50 so years. The Christian story has been getting changed, tweaked, and modified. But there are some negatives for story. And so real quickly, the two that stick out to me, number one is propaganda. I think it's very easy to emotionally manipulate people. Evangelists have used this for a long, long time. There are books written on it from the 1800s of how to give an altar call to evoke decisions from people. I fortunately in seminary didn't get to study those because that would have not appealed to me at all, nor would it appeal to Pastor Greg or any of the other men that I know, and women even that I know that are in ministry. Other negatives are advertisement. When we harness something fun and positive emotions and then we associate it with a product, BMW paid a fortune to get the Z3 and the Z4 as the Bond car. And they did it because they knew if we can associate ourselves with this really cool, eccentric, masculine sex symbol guy, he's tough, he's independent, we'll sell more cars than we would ever imagine if we can do that. Or product placement. Coca-Cola has been a master of this.
I remember back when they paid like $1 million, I think it was the second Superman movie, the one with General Zod.
That's right.
Hit that giant Coca-Cola sign and threw him through.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Product placement matters because we associate the positive emotion or that experience with whatever that thing is in proximity. So those are negative uses of story. And so I want to, in the last 10 minutes here, I want to give you what I think is the necessary first steps for us to grow as storytellers. And then next week we'll sort of dive in earnest. And I believe the very necessary first step is, and it may seem counterintuitive, but it's learning to listen. It's learning to listen. It's learning to observe and listen. Meaning we're fully present. We're actually carefully attending to the details that people around us are offering to us. It could be a coworker. It could be a family member. It may be the stranger on the street. But it's taking the time. Some characteristics we should keep in mind. Number one is it should be gracious. Gracious. There should be a safe space where people can actually share their feelings and their stories about life. And thoughts and hopes and dreams. As believers, we of all people don't need to bring judgment. Judgment has come. Why did Christ come? John 3:17, right? That the world through Him might be saved. He came with great news, not bad news, great news. But we collectively as a community of people called the church in America often have put judgment as the very first response to any social thing that we disagree with. And it doesn't mean I'm endorsing it all, but I think the Holy Spirit will convict people in its own due time. My job is to love them and present the truth to them and tell them the story, a greater story. And so now John and I have a relationship, so if I felt like he was being AWOL in his marriage, I would, in love, we would be able to have that conversation. I'm talking about strangers I don't know. I got no business passing any form of judgment verbally to them at all. I need to create a gracious space where we can talk, get to know each other. Listen, number two, it should be multi-sensory. I mean, we should seek to experience their stories through every sense we have. If you've never done that, I mean, just in a movie, if you're watching a movie, then just take that movie. What the movie's giving you is sound and sight. And just add to that, what would that smell like? What would that taste like? What would that feel like? And so if you're watching Defiance and you see the soldiers and it's wintertime and it's cold, what would that feel like? Or if you're watching, you know, Saving Private Ryan and being on Omaha Beach, and what would it feel like to have, just not knowing it, just every man around me, people are going down. What would that really feel like? I mean, these are the guys that I went through training with, and what would that feel like? Well, I mean, a part of me would want to just lay down and cry, and a part of me would just be so focused on myself that I'd be just trying to run to shelter at some level. And so practice entering into the stories through film, audio. Like, what would you feel like if you're married and your husband left for another woman and took the kids, or men, your wife left and took kids? How would you feel? Let it be reflective. And a great thing, this is great for marriage and dating and everything else. It's also great at work. I mean, the number one reason people lose their job is over unresolved conflict. So reflective listening is another phrase some people use, as drive-by or drive-through listening. It's like if you go to McDonald's and you're like, you know, I want a quarter pounder with cheese, I want a large fry and a small Coke, and they'll be like, okay, that'll be six chicken McNuggets and an iced tea. And you're like, whoa, no. What I really said was I want a quarter pounder with cheese. Reflect back to the person, summarize what they're telling you, listen to that and say, hey, so what I'm hearing you say is blank. And if they say, no, not really, say, well, help me understand that better then. And when they say, yeah, that's it, then move, reflect the emotion. Then say, man, that must be really hard. How does that make you feel? Now you're connecting not just in the story, but you're connecting at the heart level with them. But most of us, at least for me in my marriage, our first year of marriage was very simply my wife would tell me what had gone on in that day, and I would begin to say, well, you shouldn't feel that way, honey. Oh, yeah, you know they don't mean that. They absolutely don't mean that. That's crazy. Well, what does that do for people when they experience that?
Widens the gap.
It widens the gap. There's no reflective listening going on there at all. And so reflective listening is huge. And then lastly, just that multi-perspectival, just to make a word up. But think about this, practice this. It's about empathy. But as you see a story, transport yourself into a different characters. And so if you're reading a story in the Bible, and this is in your homework, so if you're reading the story of the prodigal son, and we'll talk about that next time, project yourself into the young son. Project yourself into the dad. Project yourself into the boss of the young son away from his father. What would you think? Project yourself back to the older brother. Project yourself back to the guys that slaughtered the fatted calf and then wondered where the older brother was at the party. I mean, just put yourself in another perspective and sit there and experience it. Does that make sense? So I think if we begin to cultivate better listening, what that's going to help us to do is we're going to have better stories to tell. Our characters will be more human, not less human. We'll have more sensitivity to the human condition, not indifference and apathy. Areas that are barriers for good listening, disrespect, judgment, selfishness, and hidden agendas. I think those are barriers for us. And as believers, we have received grace so that we may give grace. We have received grace so that we can give grace. Don't hear me saying there are no moral absolutes. There are moral absolutes. There are things God has declared right and wrong and good and evil. What I'm saying is, in relationship with the person X on the street, they can cohabitate, and if I say you shouldn't cohabitate, that's not going to bring them to Christ at one point at all. I mean, it doesn't help anything. But for me to walk alongside of them, So there's a barista down at Starbucks who, his brother was one of two people that died in the floods over Memorial Day weekend. Well, it's actually his brother-in-law died. Okay? So I was there when he found out, and he's crying, and I've seen him for a while. So we spend time, and we've probably had 6 hours of conversation collectively since then. But the other day he asked me, because all I've done is reflectively listen to him. I haven't told him anything about what I do. I haven't shared Jesus with him yet at all. And he finally, he said, what do you do? And I says, well, I work with men primarily, and I help them learn how to walk with Jesus in this world so that they can walk in freedom from bondage, they can walk in hope, and they can walk in love. And I said, I try to help them be successful in their marriage, successful at work. And he says, I'm a pagan. And I was like, okay, what does that mean? He says, well, I don't even think there's much of a God at all. But he said, I would love to talk more with you about this. So that was our last conversation. So I'm just telling y'all, create the space for God to begin to work in those relationships. And I believe the Holy Spirit will draw people to Him. And I'm not trying to be a coward about it, but I've done the door-to-door stuff. I've done it. I'm not saying that some people weren't ministered to by that, but I mean, I was that guy because that's the church I was a part of, and that's how we were trained to do things. And it wasn't until college that God really began to break that down, and we began to create spaces, thanks to LaBrie and writers like Edith and Francis Schaeffer and C.S. Lewis, authors like C.S. Lewis. I began to open my mind up to the fact that we can actually be gracious embodiments of God to the people that we encounter every day. It's 8 o'clock, so let me hit your homework, and then if you want to stick around and watch a funny 5-minute video on how not to listen to people. If you like Brian Regan, he's a comedian, it's hysterical. If you've already seen all of his stuff, don't worry about it, but I thought it'd be fun. Two assignments. Number one, it's on the bottom of your sheet on the back. Find an image or work of art, perhaps a favorite painting. Make up a story for it. Just give a story to it. Just jot down it. You don't have to write an essay about it. Just put the bullet points of the story so you could remember it. Because when we come in, I want you to share it around the table. Just, hey, here's the picture. And then you share your story of what you think maybe was going on or how that happened. Have fun with it. There's not you're making a story up about a picture that you enjoy. Have fun with it. There's not a right and there's not a wrong. We're cultivating story. And so one way to cultivate story is just to practice. They say it takes 5 times of telling a story before you actually tell the story effectively. And so expect to, if you're afraid of telling a story and it flops and it's bad, you'll never be a storyteller. That if you want to be a storyteller, tell it, because the first time you tell it, you'll realize, I forgot all the important things. So the second time you'll tell it, you'll remember all those important things, but you'll forget other important things. So the third time, you'll get it all factually right, but you'll be monotone and fearful of forgetting something, so you won't pay any attention to your pausing, your tone of voice, your inflection, your hands, the drama of the story. And then the last time you'll tell, the fifth time, you put it all together, and from then on, it's your story that you can share and keep it with you. And so that's one facet of your homework. The second is to choose a parable. Just make it short. You're going to share it with each other. So, I mean, being a playwright, I would say for you, make it like a 90-second, like just make a quick, this is a quick story. Like if you had a water cooler, hey, this happened today, and you share what happened. And you can get 20,000 foot on it. Or if you want to get granular, but that just gets, it'll bog way down. The other thing is to choose a parable from the sheet. So the yellow sheet has all the parables in the Synoptic Gospels. A particularly good chapter would be Matthew 13. It's sort of called the parabolic chapter. It has got one after another of parables. So next week we're going to talk about God as a storyteller, Christ as the storytelling God. And a really cool thing is Christ as the story, which I think is really neat. And we're going to pull from another source for that. But I think these parables give us also an unbelievable tool. So read it three times to become familiar with it. Then retell it in your own words to someone. Retell the parable in your own words. Don't be afraid about messing it up. Just retell the story in your own words. And then think about, what does it really mean? And then what are some other perspectives that could be taken? So if it's the mustard seed, that might be hard to get another perspective. I gave you the prodigal son story because there's so many characters in there that you can gravitate to. And then lastly, I would like you to think about, you know, how does changing perspective change the meaning for you of that parable in there? So I think those are the homework assignments there. Any questions on that stuff?
Is it unique to the gospel, the ones that don't have a number are not unique to the gospel?
Right, so they'll be shared among two or three gospels. Some of them are in all three of the synoptic gospels and others aren't. The Gospel of John truly doesn't have a prototypical parable, but we're going to look at, instead of the parables, how there's some things that happen in the Gospel of John that don't happen Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and maybe why that is unique of the Gospels, why John is a unique Gospel that I find to be highly enriching. It's my favorite Gospel, but for storytelling, not so much. The Gospel of John is not as easy to tell as Mark. Mark is one of the easier ones to tell.